Welcome to the opening of Focus Teresita Fernandez. Curated by Andrea Carnes, the show is on view through June 19th. It's my pleasure to introduce the artist here to discuss her work. After earning her BFA and MFA, she went on to hold residencies in Japan, Italy, and at Art Pace down in San Antonio, where she currently serves on the board, having been featured in solo and group museum exhibitions around the world, including at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Miami, the Corcoran in D.C., Museum of Modern Art in New York, the Center for Contemporary Art in Miami, Site Santa Fe, the Whitney, among others. She also has site-specific work installed at Seattle's Olympic Park, where I might add she was the youngest artist to be commissioned to install there, at Vanessa Artside in Naoshima, Japan, and at Dallas Cowboys Stadium. Teresita has received many fellowships and awards, and including the 2005 MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, a 2003 Guggenheim Fellowship, and the 1999 Lewis Comfort Tiffany Biennial Award. Please join me in welcoming Teresita Fernandez.
Hear me okay? Thank you so much for the introduction. Let me move this down a little bit. These things are always strange. There, we'll try that. Well, thank you for coming out on a Sunday to see the show. What I'd like to do is to maybe start in this gallery, which is the oldest piece of the three conceptual, even though they're all pretty new. The other two were made specifically for this exhibition. And I'd like to give you a kind of overview of my process. And I'm hoping that we, maybe what we'll do, since we have about an hour, right? Maybe what I'll do is, before we leave each gallery, I'll take a couple of questions just to break it up a little, and we'll be in the space that we're talking about. And, you know, I'll leave plenty of time at the end, and I welcome questions, because it gets tiring to just talk. So if you have questions, it makes it much more animated and dynamic, and probably the question you have is very similar to the question that the others have, and it's sort of the whole point of me being here, is that we can have a more intimate exchange about the work. What you're seeing in this room is a wall drawing. It's made all out of graphite, and I've been working with graphite for about a year and a half, 2 years. And to begin, I think of myself as a conceptual artist. I'm very interested in the sort of the visual and the sensorial aspects of art making, but my process begins as a concept and as a kind of conceptual development, and it then turns into this. So when I first started, it's not like I just found graphite and then started working with it. There was a whole conceptual framework that led me to even graphite as a material, and that began a kind of inquiry that continued to kind of build on itself, and it's sort of typical of the way that I work. I'm most often really interested in historical references that I start to kind of peel apart and layer onto other things, and basically what I'm doing is I'm kind of trying to invent something out of nothing, and to take information from different places that inspire me, and to kind of try to see things in a new way. And I don't know exactly how I do that. It's just sort of a very subjective process that I meander through. I do spend a lot of time doing research, meaning reading, writing, historical research, before I ever touch a material. This body of work with the graphite came out of an initial interest in the history of landscape drawing. So while we're all quite burst art historically in the history of painting, there's always this kind of like in-between gap when it comes to the history of landscape drawing, and that sort of piqued my interest. When we look at the history of landscape drawing, there are many examples in China and in Japan, very old references to drawing and to the landscape. But in the West, we can pretty much trace the history of landscape drawing to a drawing by Leonardo da Vinci of the Arno Valley that was done in the early 1500s. And it's the first time in the West that we kind of we believe it's the oldest landscape drawing, and it's the first time that we really see landscape being represented for its own sake, not as a background to something, not as a way of giving information about the setting of a painting or of a portrait, but really just sort of landscape for its own sake. And in this little drawing of the Arno Valley that Leonardo da Vinci made, it's believed that he made it from memory, and which is very different than sitting in front of something and trying to recreate it. And there's this whole connection for me between drawing and thinking, drawing and writing, drawing and reading. They're all very much connected. Out of all the sort of modes of making art, drawing really, at least for me, encompasses this very immediate, it's almost like thinking out loud. And whatever I make, even if it looks like a drawing or a painting or whatever, I always kind of think of it as a drawing in a sense. So back to the history of landscape drawing, I became interested in graphite as a material, and graphite can be traced also to the early 1500s. It's the same material that's still in your pencil and that we still use to draw with today, no matter how technologically advanced we become, and no matter how many versions of Photoshop come out, there's still this immediacy to graphite in your hand that has been pretty much irreplaceable for artists and for thinkers and for school children and for all kinds of people. So graphite can be traced to Borrowdale, England. It's the lake region in the north of England, and in the early 1500s it was discovered and it's mined. It basically is under the earth. Under the surface of the earth, and Borrowdale is a rural area, so it looks like sort of rolling farmland. And at the time, it was, and since it's been the richest deposit of graphite that has ever been found in the world. Now, graphite today is mined all over the world, but it's of very different qualities. The graphite that I use comes from one particular mine in Sri Lanka, and it took me about a year to find this stuff. So I looked at a lot of graphite. This is the one that was right. It's very soft, and it has a very particular luster to it that was right for the kind of project that I wanted to make. So in a sense, if you can imagine Borrowdale, which is this very beautiful green landscape, and if you can imagine that you're standing on the ground looking out at this very verdant sort of vista, but under you is the solid bed of graphite, you can start to sort of think of it as a kind of land art or as a kind of three-dimensional drawing, as a kind of landscape drawing that in fact is not representational but actually physically present and real and that you're implied in it. So I became really fascinated by this sort of poetic reference to graphite as being physically a part of the landscape and a physical drawing. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to make sculptures that felt like drawings and drawings that felt like sculpture. Some of the pieces that I made, which aren't included in this exhibition, include a very large sculptural work that's made completely out of raw and machined graphite, and it's in a sense like a big three-dimensional smudge, a big three-dimensional gesture that sits in the room. This piece is called Epic, and it's actually a couple pieces put together that I've installed in this particular way in this particular gallery. This piece looks different every time that I show it. So in this gallery, what I wanted to do is have it be more of an immersive environment that you actually walked into. So yes, it's a drawing, but it's also kind of a sculpture, and it's also kind of an installation that is very particular to the room that we're standing in, the opening of this doorway, the way it frames the purlieu, all of the elements that make this space that we're standing in very specific. I wanted to think of the word drawing both as a verb and as a noun. So when we say, I'm drawing a picture of you, we're using it as a verb. When we say, I just finished my drawing, it's the same word, but we're talking about it as a noun. And so in this piece, which is a very labor-intensive piece that was worked on by my assistant Hiroki and many student volunteers who were really wonderful. Each mark is made by hand. The mark is made with graphite, so it sort of manifests this idea of the act of drawing, each mark being individually made, and then at the top of each mark is an actual solid piece of graphite that's been cut down to a particular size that is connected to that mark. So it becomes like the finished object of the drawing. And all put together, it's really about this kind of atmospheric effect that it creates, which is meant to feel very ephemeral and very fleeting, like most drawings really are, like a kind of gesture, even though making it, of course, is much more labor intensive than that. It's all about the end result, you know, and this kind of suspension of disbelief or this ephemeral moment or atmospheric moment that's created. I like to not talk so much about things like hardware and how things get put up on the wall because they're not that interesting to me, but I'd much rather talk about ideas. But if you have any questions about how things are made to look this way, I'm happy to answer them in some capacity, although I'm always a little bit, you know, it's always a little disconcerting when you spend like an hour talking about your ideas and somebody's like, how do you attach it to the wall? And it's like you kind of want a slightly more inspired question. But so really quickly, these are attached to the wall with magnets. And it's really just a hardware solution. It's not about the magnets. The graphite's not magnetic. I tried a bunch of different things. The magnet is really neat, and it works, and it attaches to the wall. So if you're a docent and you're here taking notes, it's a nice thing to note, but it's not the most important aspect of the piece. So it's kind of nice when it doesn't get presented as like, this is put up on the wall with magnets, because it's a little bit like it pulls the rug from under you, like it undoes, and it's not that interesting if you see how it's put up, it's really just hardware, but it takes a little bit of the magic away from it. But does anyone have any questions about Epic and Smata? Yes?
Yeah, I'll ask you, I'm sorry to get away from the spiritual for a minute, show my ignorance, but no, so the graphite put up with magnets, but how about all the graphite drawings? Those look to be site-specific that will not last after this is taken down, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And then how do you get all the graphite drawings on there? How do you place them? How is that done?
Mm-hmm.
What is the framework that transfers it from your concept to the wall?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll answer that. For starters, it's funny you use the word spiritual because I actually think of it as a very rigorous process, both conceptually and physically. And the spiritual is perhaps the hardest thing to get at as an artist. So it's not the easiest, it's the hardest. It's much easier to just be rigorous. But to answer your question, these pieces are put on the wall with templates. So this piece potentially can look exactly the same every time that it's installed. The way I've installed it here, I've taken into account the doorway and things that I've sort of adjusted to the space, but I can install this piece to look exactly the same every single time because there are a set of large vinyl templates that could get put up on the wall and each point is marked. So that answers the first part of your question. The second part is each mark is made by hand. There's a little bit of graphite deposited right on that point that's marked on the wall from the template, and then with a foam brush, somebody actually draws and renders out that mark. So it's very handmade. And as technical as it gets, it's still a very handmade mark, and that's important to me.
How long did it take to put this up?
It took a week, and there were about 8 people working on it full time.
How do you train them to make the same pressure on the graphite?
Well, that's a very good question because everyone has a slightly different. Some people are really good at it, some people aren't, some people can't do it at all. I mean, it's a very subjective thing, it's a mark. I have a great assistant whose name is Hiroki, like I said, and he's traveled all over the world installing these pieces for me, so he's really kind of the expert on it now. He's much better at it than I am. I just figured out how to do it and did a few and taught him. So he's really great at managing the team of people, of volunteers, and training them. And then we do other things like everybody's up on the scaffolding for an extended period of time, but every 20 or 30 minutes we switch. Everybody switches position so that there's no one area representative of one kind of mark making. And you know what happens is that it's almost like a peripheral buzzing. When your eyes, the way our eyes work, when you're stimulated and bombarded by many, many, many different points, it becomes very hard to select one point. It's sort of what creates this optical effect. So if one mark is a little off, you kind of don't notice it because there are so many things. But if you have an area that's been made a certain way that's different than the rest, you know, like a little crooked or a little darker or a little lighter, you start to notice. So we just keep having those eight people rotate the part of the wall that they're working on constantly throughout the whole installation.
Can you erase a mark if it's gone wrong?
No, you can't. You can't. You would essentially have to paint the wall again and start from scratch. Yes?
Is the composition referential, intuitive, a mix? And can you also talk about the three-dimensional sense of that? I mean, it's actually three-dimensional, but there's this vertical movement as well as this horizontal movement.
I forgot the first part of your question.
The first part was, is it referential?
Is it referential? It's a mix, because kind of what I'm looking at is, you know, there's this very interesting point between representation and abstraction. So people get abstraction, people get representation. When you start to mix the two, people get, even today, people get really thrown off because they want to call it something. They want to say, oh, this is a landscape, or oh, this is a cloud, or they want to say, oh, that's abstract. And the truth is that you can't abstract something unless you know what it looks like. So for me, representation and abstraction are exactly the same thing. They're just sort of like modes of abstraction or representation. So what I'm really thinking about and looking about when I'm doing these are, this particular piece is the land, the background of very traditional landscape paintings. They've just been taken out of context. It's also intuitive in the sense that when I'm working on the original template, so the template that I install this with is set, it's done. But when I'm working on that template in the studio, I project it onto the wall, and I'm actually moving those dots around constantly. So it's more like a painting. I'm putting them up, I'm stepping back, I'm reacting to something, I'm changing it again. The closer together I put them, the denser it becomes, the darker it gets. So it's like shading something darker. The farther apart the points are, the more it looks like a highlight. So it's really very, it's almost classical in the way that it's painted, drawn. The three-dimensional parts, tell me again what you asked.
I was just interested in how you came about this scheme of there's a vertical movement and then there's a horizontal.
Yeah, I kind of wanted it to look like each mark was the shadow of the piece. And I've made other works that are like the piece that's in Linda's collection with the cubes. And each individual element will cast a shadow or a reflection on the wall. So I was kind of playing on that idea that, you know, is that mark made by this piece of graphite? Is the piece of graphite casting that shadow? What's real, what's not? What is that sort of very narrow place between the two and the three-dimensional? So I'm asking myself those questions too and trying to play around with that. If there are no other questions, we can move on to the next gallery too, just so we keep it moving. So this piece, which is a brand new piece, is called Nocturnal Japan, and I've made a series of pieces of wall panels like this made out of graphite that all have nocturnal in the title, and then they have something else in parentheses, so the name of this one is Nocturnal Japan. And as I was working with the graphite that I get raw out of the the mine and sent to me, I started to sort of expand my vocabulary with the material and to try to really think of how else I could redefine this idea of drawing. So this is it's everything on this panel. It's a wooden panel, and everything on it is graphite. So it's either solid graphite or polished graphite or liquid graphite, and the graphite is the same exact graphite that you just saw in the other room. It's just used differently. Again, it's if you play with something long enough, you can make it do all kinds of things. There's no big trick to this. There's no big, like, you know, graphite secret society where you figure out how to make things. You just do stuff with it, and you start to discover what it does. There's kind of no guidebook for that. This is what artists do in their studios all the time, is they just take a material and try to make it do something that it doesn't necessarily do. So I wanted to make a piece that was, this whole series is really about making a piece that's a little bit like a drawing, a little bit like a painting, a little bit like a sculpture, a little bit like architecture, all of these things. Most of the ones that I've made of this series are smaller. This is the biggest one that I've made to date, and I made it very specifically, not just for this show, but for this wall and for this building. I've spent a lot of time in Japan. I lived there about 11, 12 years ago when I was doing a residency, and it's always been, the Japanese have always really gotten my work. I always had more of a career there way before people even knew who I was here, and I always really connected to the Japanese aesthetic. So it was this really kind of nice, just a nice part of my sensibility of the visual. And when I came into I also did a piece last year in Naoshima in Japan, which is of course Ando's other great building. It's almost like, in a way, it's almost like the sister museum of this one, and that there's this really nice dialogue between the two. So I, having worked in an Ando building and making a big site-specific installation, I understood the aesthetic of his work very much, and I like his work very much. So the first time that I was in this museum, I really kind of fell in love with the architecture, and I knew that I wanted to try to use this Ando sensibility, which is a sensibility that's connected to the traditional Japanese interior. So if you go to, say, for example, to Kyoto, if you look at traditional Japanese architecture, there's always this connection between the interior and the landscape. There's something called shakei. I made a piece called Borrowed Landscape some time ago when I was a resident at ArtPace. And Borrowed Landscape is sort of a bad English translation of a traditional Japanese gardening technique called shakei. And in shakei, if you ever go to Kyoto, for example, and you're inside one of these temples, you'll see that there's a whole wall kind of missing. It's almost like the wall becomes like a window. So not like a window in a wall, but the whole wall is almost removed so that it becomes this view onto the landscape. And in this technique, in shakei, what happens is that everything within that rectangle, and if you walk around this museum, there are many framed moments like this out by the cafe where you have these like rectangles that frame the vistas. It's the same kind of thing. So in shakei, you have this composition where maybe there's a bush or a hedge in the foreground, maybe you have Mount Fuji in the background, you have something in this middle ground, and it's all composed. And when you're in the Japanese interior, which is tends to be very dark, this whole outside scene almost looks like a diorama. It's almost like it's like a projection that's lit up. It's very beautiful and had a huge impact on me when I was a student there many years ago. So I wanted to treat this wall almost like that, almost like if I could remove the wall and insert the view of the water outside of the museum. Because we know, you know, there's something as we walk around this wonderful building and we're looking at the collection, there's this kind of psychological thing that's happening. It's very quiet, where you kind of feel, whether you're aware of it or not, that you're walking on water or surrounded by water or that you're on an island. And all of those things play into your psychological and physical sense of the things around you. So in a sense, this seascape, this landscape is a reference to the Seto Inland Sea, where I spent time in southern Japan, but also a reference to the water right outside of the building, as if though we could remove this wall from the museum and have a view of that water that Anda has put on the other side of it. This piece is a little different too and new in that I've started to introduce color. A lot of what you see is basically, I'm just noticing I missed one. A lot of what you see too is just a drawing on top of a drawing on top of a drawing. So some of these marks are just pencil. They're just like a pencil, like a traditional pencil. So it's really just like graphite on top of graphite. And then I started to work a little bit with color pencils to make my guidelines so that you have this very subtle kind of blue underneath that's showing through. I've always been fascinated by this idea that to be dazzled by something and to be blinded by something are visually the same exact thing. So there's this sensibility that by dimming something, I'm actually revealing it. And even though it's a very dark drawing, which when it's in my studio, for example, it just looks really dark. It looks like a black, you know, like Ad Reinhardt minimalist black painting. And when there's a little light on it, you start to see that it's in fact like this kind of picturesque scene. So again, this kind of like teetering between something that's really, really representational and sort of embraces this romantic tradition of representation of the landscape, and that at the same time can be totally abstract. I was thinking about things like Malevich, and Malevich's wonderful abstractions. Malevich is actually a super interesting character, because if you look at early Malevich, you see these figures. The work is very, very figurative, and in the background you have these like just horizontal lines, which are representative of the landscape. And if you look at later Malevich, which is what we think of as Malevich, all you have left are the horizontal lines. And there's just like this tiny step between something being representational and something being totally abstract. And it's almost a trick of the mind, but there's not a big difference between the two. So in some of these, they're much more extreme, like it'll really just be like three horizontal bands. And then in others, you know, I might insert the stars, the little points on the top, which by putting in this reference to the stars, all of a sudden it becomes more like a landscape. And playing around with these degrees of detail can really change how the image is read as a whole. Any questions?
I'll ask a question.
Okay.
The fact that the substance is different, when graphite comes to you, you get a pound of graphite, is any of this baked? Is it heated? How do you get it? You know, how do you apply it?
Okay. Well, I don't bake it because I'd like to be around for a long time for my children. And I think history has offered us many lessons of artists who breathed a lot of really toxic stuff for their art, and I'm sort of not that committed. But actually, graphite is really interesting as a material because it's just carbon. It's actually the most stable, most pure form of carbon, and it's not toxic. If graphite stays in the ground for long enough, it becomes diamonds. That's it. It's actually more pure than diamonds in a way. Diamonds have just been heated longer, so it's the same exact material. And I love this idea. I love this idea that when I make these little stars, for example, I always think of that. I always think of the graphite as just this version of the same material as a diamond. So I don't melt it, but I can't tell you exactly how I did it because it took me a year to figure out how to do it. And you know, it's a little bit like my process, like what happens in the privacy of my studio. And I also worked with chemists and developed some materials that don't exist on the market that allowed me to stabilize the graphite so that if I touch this, it doesn't come off on my hand anymore. If you touch the graphite the way it comes out of the mine, it's really messy. It's just like you're black, like your hands just get like black full of graphite. So yeah, there's a little bit of some trade secrets there that are private to my studio, but not so interesting. Much more interesting for you to imagine how it is that it's done. Yeah.
Did you work on each panel separately at different times?
Yes, and that's kind of the only reason why it's broken up in three panels is because actually, you can kind of see, I work with assistants, although with these pieces, they're really like 98% me, like myself, because I think of them as a drawing, and I think as an artist, I'm like, I get a lot of help for a lot of things, and sometimes I make very big pieces where I need to bring in engineers and, you know, really good craftsmen, but I always think that drawing is really about the hand of the artist and that kind of immediacy, so I'm a little... I don't know, I still really enjoy that process. So these pieces, there's still a lot of like, it's kind of just me there. I might have somebody, you know, we call it like the dental hygienist, you know, like handing stuff to the dentist. We kind of laugh in the studio because it's a little bit like that. So I have people like kind of helping me, handing me stuff, but it's my hand. In these, it's my hand. In those, I have a lot of help. But what was I gonna say? Sorry, I just blanked. The three pieces, okay. So yeah, so you can kind of see, you know, I have to be able to reach this far to get to that middle section. I can't work on them vertically. I have to work on them, you know, flat. So that this is the biggest one I've done, and, you know, yeah, at some points I'm kind of, like, sort of sitting on top of it. Not very often, but the bigger they get, the more I have to be in it in order to get to certain sections. And
did you ever consider like
building kind of like a trap with the nails so that you can lie on top? Oh yeah, I don't want to do that. No, I don't want to do that. I don't make something long enough to do that. So I've been doing these for like a year and a half. I'm onto something else. If you look at my work, or if there, I think there's some books in the bookstore, but if you look at the work I made 2 years ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago, conceptually, there's a thread that runs through all of the work. It all looks like I did it because of the way I work and the references and the way I kind of develop an idea. But the way I use materials, it changes all the time. So one body of work might look nothing like the next body of work. Or it might, but it might be like, it might be a totally different use of the images and the materials. So it's not like I need to make these for another 10 years, so I don't need the contraption that hangs me over them. I get tired of doing the same thing, so once I'm not that interested anymore, I'm usually, like if I'm showing this here, usually in my mind, in my studio, I'm about 9 months ahead of whatever I'm showing, you know? So right now I'm working on shows that I'm doing next year, and they're not, they don't look like this kind of work. So it's always changing.
Yes. And just add to that, you're saying that you use interest, but also one thing grows from another, right? While you're doing this, it triggers something else that you're interested in investigating.
It does, it absolutely does. It absolutely does. In fact, the piece in the next one is the latest piece, the newest piece, and it totally comes out of these works. So You can kind of see the projection, the progression of the pieces, and we can move over there. Okay, so this is a piece that I also made specifically for this show, and I don't know how many of you have seen the collection at the stadium. If you haven't, you should all book a tour, because there's some really amazing works of art that are pretty much in your own backyard, and that are, it really, the whole stadium really kind of redefines the whole idea of public art, and there's some magnificent, very large-scale works there. But my piece, which isn't that accessible because it's outside of the owner's club, so it's not in one of the more public areas, if you do see it, this is almost like a three-dimensional sculptural version of that piece, which is called Starfield. This piece is called Ink Sky, and it's made of anodized aluminum, which is the black surface underneath, rhodium-plated chains, and on the end of these metal, hanging metal sections, This is not graphite. I know it looks like graphite because I kind of set you up for it to be graphite, but it's not. And it's like what Annette says. It's an example of just how things are moving in the studio. The little rocks on the end are galena, which is a form of iron ore. And so when I'm doing these things, it's not like I go to the iron ore store or to the graphite store. Like this, you can't get any of this stuff at Home Depot. So the chains either, like the chains were all custom made for me in Korea, and they're very, very custom made. So each one has a slightly different diameter to it. Things that you would probably wouldn't notice, but which add to the specificity of the piece. And I'm only mentioning that because it takes a lot of time to figure out, you know, so you have this idea, and then I kind of have this idea, and then I kind of want to use this material, but I really don't know how to do that. I have to teach myself how to do that. And it's again, that moment of invention of sort of making something from nothing. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't work. There are very few times where I just like stumble upon a material and say, hey, I'd like to use this. This is cool. It almost never happens to me. So there's this whole part of my research that's just about figuring out how what I'm imagining in my mind can actually be made. So I had this galena mined for me. It comes from Missouri, and it comes in big sections, and then in my studio they're all cut down into these smaller sections, and we kind of make all of the components. All of this comes apart in sections just like the other pieces. There's this common thread that we've seen in all three of the spaces, and that is that there's a reference to this kind of celestial event, this kind of meteor shower. It's very different in each gallery, but there's something consistent about it. It's about a kind of phenomenon. It's about not making a static object that just looks like sky or this or that, but actually trying to harness the sensibility of an event, something of witnessing something, of something that sort of unfolds before your eyes. And the other thing that's consistent in the three, and that maybe this is a more advanced, in my mind, version, not advanced better, but just further, more recent version of it, is that there's this sense of looking above your head, which is a gesture in the kind of way that we see the world that's always been very very much of interest to me. I'm always interested in an ambulatory viewer. If you go out to your Sierra, you have the sensibility that you understand and you see both the landscape, things far away and things close, by walking. You know, and so it's an active, dynamic kind of seeing. It's not about the gallery stroll where you're like coming here, looking at a painting, going to the next one. It's not frontal. It's above your head and under your feet and around you. And it's an immersive kind of experience. But in that kind of thinking, there's this sense that you're standing on this plane, and it takes us back full circle to my first description of Borrowdale with the graphite underground being mined, like standing on a big solid drawing. And there's this theme that I keep coming back to, which is taking something from underground, so a material that's mined, like graphite or galena, and using it to refer to something that's in fact celestial or spatial or cosmic, you know. And it's actually something that I'm just starting to get into more now for another project that I'm going to do next year. But in our collective history of myths, you know, universal myths, there's always this connection between, you know, this sort of mystery of the underground and the heavens. And always human beings, as old as time, have always looked up to the sky as a surface that's red. So the night sky has always been a surface that's red, either for navigation or for information about the future or for a kind of answer, you know. And you know, in many different capacities, you can kind of interpret that any way you want. It's not necessarily spiritual. Sometimes, I mean, I certainly, that's not what even what I was thinking about when I did this, but in terms of just sort of like factual information, we are tied as human beings to looking at the night sky for information then and now. And that piece is a little bit about that. Any questions?
I was standing right underneath it looking at it. I felt that, you know, I'm the center, because with the dark background, it feels like I'm the center of the universe.
It feels like you're the center of the universe, yeah.
Yeah, the energy comes out from the center.
Well, I invite you to walk underneath it, because part of the point of this piece is that the black surface is reflective, so if you stand underneath and you look up, you will see your own reflection upside down and reverse. So you're kind of implied and projected onto this night surface. Shay, you had a question.
You spoke a little bit about the influence of Japanese interiors with this particular work.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask a more general question about the effect of, because I'm very interested in the subject, the effect of architecture on sort of the body of the work. Mm-hmm. A little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. It's less evident now, but if you look at my earlier work from, I don't know, 15 years ago, like my student work and my first big installations, they were all, people used to refer to my work as architectural, which was kind of funny, because if you just make something, if you make a sculpture big enough, people think it's architectural, but sometimes it has nothing to do with architecture. But at the time, I was very interested in feminist architectural theory and feminist film theory, and so there were some things about spaces and interiors that were interesting to me, you know, things like, you know, the white wall in the museum that we take for granted is actually, as being this very pure surface, is actually politically loaded. So there were lots of moments in my past work that I've been specifically interested in architecture, but for me the connection between architecture and sculpture and whatever it is that I do, whatever you want to call that, does have to do with this immersive experience. And so perhaps architecture is the sort of second biggest reference point that we have in terms of size. Landscape is the biggest, right? Landscape is, of course, the most grandiose, but it's almost like, if you think of it as almost like wearing clothing, you know, so you've got like this clothing that's like touching your body, and then you've got, you know, the room that you're in, and then you've got the museum, and then you've got the landscape. And so, but they're really just sort of like degrees of distance. And I think that the way that I imagine that the viewer, for lack of a better word, moves through a space is very much the way you move from an interior to an exterior, or the way you kind of, you're standing here, but you're looking at that's 10 miles away, or the way this piece occupies this room that we're standing in. So they're very sort of specific moments that, for lack of a better word or a kind of laziness, we say architectural, but it's a lot of other things too. It's spatial and it's immersive.
You tend to work on a lot of smaller works by working on larger, extensive work.
I tend to work on a lot of things at once, just because I have a lot of deadlines. So sometimes I make, like the piece next door, the big panel piece, I love making the little small ones. So the small ones that are about this big feel to me almost as big as that big one, but the medium ones don't. So there's this connection for me between the little tiny ones and the big 18 feet huge one. And I do. I make a lot of small pieces sometimes, but I'm usually working on probably, I don't know, 5 or 6, 7 things at once. And there may be some big things, some small things, some things that never get shown, some things that are more about figuring stuff out, some things that are about, you know, I don't know. I mean, models. I'm usually working on a lot of different things at once, in different capacities. Yes.
I'm looking at this, I think you might be influenced from one time or another by the cold work, right? You know, where you had things hanging in the darkness.
Well, you hang anything without, you know, thinking of Calder. He kind of like has the market cornered on hanging anything. So if you're just like, if you're just an artist who happens to be alive and you hang something, you know, you, any reference to a mobile is sort of, yeah, it brings up Calder. But I admire Calder's work from a sort of, you know, historical perspective. But I would say, you know, there are a lot of other things that were hanging before Calder made hanging art. Even in very ancient architecture, and things like hanging gardens and all sorts of references that are there way before Calder. So I'm not so interested in Calder, but I also am fully aware as an artist that you kind of always, Calder's always implied anytime anybody hangs anything. It's just, you know, it's just part of the, it's like using Yves Klein blue or something. It's just, it's a mnemonic device. It's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just like a kind of mnemonic device where it suggests something else because it's so embedded in our collective cultural reference. And I think for sure that, you know, any artist of my generation can't help but be a product or to be influenced by, for example, many of the artists that you have represented in this collection. I don't know any artist of my generation that, regardless of what they do and what their work looks like, can't help but be influenced by Donald Judd or Robert Smithson or, you know, so many other, you know, important artists that are part of my history. Yes.
This part about taking off the point that he just made about rather than Calder, I was thinking about how much gravity seems to play in all of your work, even your two-dimensional, just from the material that you're using. I think about the weight of it and how light looks the two-dimensional piece or the hybrid or this piece, about how airy it is, but you also think about the weight of it.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a kind of a, it's almost like, you know, we have a sense of, we have two kinds of sensibility. We have a kind of visual sensibility and a psychological sensibility, but we also have within that visual sensibility, we also have a tactile visual sensibility, so that even if we're not touching things or actually feeling their weight, we, you know, it's a very fascinating subject for me, actually. Sometimes referred to as the eyes of the skin. So there's this also reference to the visual, the tactile aspect of looking, where your eyes almost like graze a surface, and it's a very kinesthetic connection to a material, where without actually touching it, you have a very visceral sense of what it feels like. So I think that's very perceptive and very accurate, and it's something that I'm interested in. I'm also like a sculptor. I think of myself as a sculptor. I've never painted much. I never took a painting class. And there's it's often been said, and I think that it's true, that people who have a more sculptural background, their drawings have a particular quality to them that's evident in the materiality. In my case, I think that's very true.
Is there a pop culture reference in this piece in particular?
Only if you want there to be.
The spirituality is beautiful, so I apologize for the mundane, but do you use any mathematical formulas such as Fibonacci sequencing or anything to determine the length of the rods?
I did, yes. Not, I wouldn't say mathematical, but I had somebody else figure out the mathematical part, but it's based on a model that I made, and I did many models, three-dimensional renderings of the density, the height, the diameter of each chain, the proximity of each chain, and so if I take 50 of these chains out, it looks very different. The chains, vary in length from 4 inches to 34 inches at 2-inch increments. So there are probably, I don't know, what is that, like 15, 20 different lengths of chains.
Do you compute a model before you do it?
I'm sorry?
Do you computer model it before you do it? Or just
I work with somebody who takes my models and turns them into a computer model that can be read by the person fabricating it, yeah. I have output, so I basically have, if I want it to look this way, I need X amount of this length, X amount of that length, yeah.
Did you fabricate this yourself, or is this fabricated by, you know, like Judd has some stuff fabricated? I mean, do you place each piece up there, or your assistants, or do you, is that done by a fabricator?
Well, this piece actually comes apart. The whole thing comes apart. Every chain comes down. The black thing comes apart into sections, and if you look at the top of each chain, there's a little hook. There's a tiny little attachment, and that was all done in my studio. Yeah, so I placed each of those. You're welcome.
Does all of your work have a meditative quietness and stillness to it? You mentioned the Japanese aesthetic, which certainly is obvious.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't set out to make it that way, but I think I somehow end up there often. But it's less about a style or about a desire for it to be that way, and more about that's where the process ends up taking me. I would say in general, my work does have a kind of quiet, meditative quality. But it's almost like, it's also very detailed, and I think that it's almost like what I'm asking the viewer to do is to slow down in order to notice the details, because it's actually quite dynamic and there's a lot going on. But I'm not so interested in the quick view. It's not a quick piece, you know? Other pieces are they give very quickly, and you kind of take very quickly and you digest them and you walk away. So I would say my work is not so much about that. I don't care that much about that way of looking. I'm more interested in whether or not the piece can kind of have, first of all, slow the viewer down to notice what it's really about. And then secondly, whether or not it can kind of linger ephemerally, like in your mind, after the piece is no longer in front of you. So if it can kind of like haunt you a little bit, the image or the sensation, that's more what I'm interested in.
The piece is almost atmospheric.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, I guess one more question would be great.
One question about the color variation, because you said you put a color green pencil at the bottom, but after it, you know, the graphic cover, then how do the colors still show?
Well, I used I usually just use pencil, but in this one I started to use color pencil because I wanted, it's just blue, but I just wanted to be able to see the lines better because I didn't have great lighting in my studio, and then I just kind of liked how the blue looked. So that's another example. You walk in, it looks like it's all monochromatic, but if you actually spend a little bit more time and you get closer to it, you realize that there's blue in there. So it's subtle, but it's there. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.